Welcome back. I'm glad to be with you. I can see that something about our sessions in the late summer have caused all of you to retreat as far as possible from the front rows, but that's fine. Steve thought I should say a little bit about what I've done since August. Or September, whenever it was. So very briefly, when we were together last, I was in the middle of some significant transition out of a role at Rosedale Bible College into whatever was next, and it wasn't entirely clear what that would be. I ended up teaching through the fall at Rosedale and ended formally my assignment at the school at the end of the last calendar year, and on New Year's Day, Dawn and I flew to Honduras, where we were beginning about a little over four month teaching assignment with a ministry, initially in Honduras just for a couple of weeks, but mostly in Costa Rica. So we've been in Latin America now for a month. We had worked in Latin America early in our marriage, and have been kind of in and out a few times since, but this is really the first time in about 30 years that we've been immersed in life in Latin America and doing a lot of teaching and speaking. Phyllis asked yesterday when they picked me up at the airport. I flew in just last evening from a climate which I think could best be characterized as different. Average high temperatures during the weeks we've been there have been 80 degrees. Average low temperatures are 60 degrees and sunny about 98% of the time. So I won't say any more about that. We're really enjoying this opportunity to reconnect with Latin American Mennonite churches primarily, doing a lot of teaching during the week in a training program that we're part of, and then also it looks like we'll be doing a good bit of speaking in churches on the weekends. So they asked, does this feel like a vacation? And I said, no, it definitely does not feel like a vacation, what we've been doing so far. We've been very busy, but also a lot of satisfaction in sort of renewing and making some new connections there. Last fall, when we were together, we did a very quick overview of roughly the first half of what would normally be considered a survey of Christian Bible doctrine. And if you remember that, it was intense. It was relentless. I think we had 10 one-hour sessions between Friday morning and Sunday noon. There was, I think, a consensus in reflection on that schedule. It maybe was a little bit too much, so we scaled back for this time around. And if you've looked at your schedule, you'll notice that we still have a lot of sessions. We're still going to try to cover a lot of territory, but we're going to do it in 7 45-minute sessions. The good news is it'll be a little more relaxed in terms of number and time. The bad news is the material hasn't gone away. So we're going to race along through as much of this as we can. And let me just say again, like I think I told you last fall, the purpose of this is really twofold. It's to give you a kind of snapshot view of the important themes in Christian theology and doctrine. But more importantly, it can serve, I think, to whet your appetite for further reading, further study, give you an idea of what things there are that you might wish you knew more about. And the resources that you have at your disposal are enormous. There's lots of thick books. There's even some thin books that you can read on any of these themes that we'll be looking at. and you can spend the rest of your lives, as in a sense I'm doing as well, learning, tweaking, finding out more, reading the new proposals that are coming, because there's always people talking about maybe a better way of understanding some traditional discussion in the realm of Christian theology. And some of them end up maybe not being so helpful, and others of them are, and some of them end up being declared heretical by other people. And so the discussion continues and probably will continue for as long as we're alive. We'll turn our attention in this first session to the subject of sin. Such a cheerful way to start a series on a bleak winter morning, but that's what's on the schedule. So we're going to talk about sin, and then after lunch we get to move on and talk about salvation, which is more cheerful. But we've got a half hour to say everything that needs to be said this morning about sin. So let's start talking. There was an author back in the 60s, I think it was, who wrote about what he discussed as the problem of sin in a secular age. His name was Carl Menninger. He wrote about sort of the disappearance of sin as a concept in Western discussions, in Western academia especially. And the way he framed it essentially was this. He said, we live in a secular age. We live in an era when secularism, and secularism simply means worldliness. It comes from the Latin word seculum, which just means this world. Secularism focuses on this world and sort of what we see, what we experience in the material world. And Menninger suggested that sin as a meaningful concept, a concept which had gotten a great deal of attention in the couple of thousand years preceding our era, between the launching of the Christian era and the mid-20th century when he was writing, where sin had gotten a lot of attention in prior generations, coming along to the middle and later of the 20th century, sin had really become kind of a problematic concept. Like, what does that even mean? What is sin? He said, sin has often been redefined in our world, either as crime. We have a category of crime, namely offenses against sort of legal decrees. And among psychologists and people helpers, we now have kind of categories of maybe what used to be sin, now defined as sickness. So if you look at the DSM manuals that are constantly being updated that describe the things that go wrong with people, things that maybe used to be categories for theological discussion, things that were understood to be offenses against God, offenses against the moral order, aren't talked about that way in the helping professions. They're like problems that need to be fixed. They're sicknesses, maybe even sort of psychological disorders. But sin in the modern world, we're reluctant to talk about that, because to use the word sin implies religion, God, commitment to some moral structure that we know not everybody accepts. And so how can we talk meaningfully about sin in a secular world? And as you know, the whole phenomenon of faith and the rest of life being increasingly separated, at least in many places and in many workplaces, that's an ongoing development in the Western world, where 100 years ago, it would have been common, even in public spaces, for there to be some overlap between religious life and the rest of life. In the 20th century, this march toward separating those things moved steadily forward. I'm a graduate of the Ohio State University, Lau, and the O, I always thought the O was like maybe the number of times we had lost to Iowa. I don't know. If you go back 100 years, Ohio State and Iowa, I think, and a bunch of other public universities has been established as part of the land grant processes of the last half of the 19th century. Public universities, basically for the people who weren't bright enough to get into the Ivy League, I think was the idea. Like, even Midwesterners need to be educated. So let's make some schools for them and let's call them, oh, how about agriculture and mechanical colleges? And so that's actually what most of them were started as. Agricultural Mechanical College is the only one that's kept the name, I think, is Texas A&M, which has retained that old name with pride in their case. Most everyone else has dumped the A&M part, and we're just now universities. Ohio State University in 1900 had chapels, required chapels, that students at this public land-grant, state-funded university, they had to go to chapel. Like, isn't that strange? Compare that to kind of the ethos of the Ohio State campus or the Michigan campus or the Iowa campus, whichever one you choose and prefer. It's really different. And we could argue about whether it's better or worse. There's reasons, I think, as Anabaptists, to think that the separation of religion and public life isn't a completely bad thing, because to the extent that they overlap and you try to weave them together, to that extent, arguably, the Christian piece of it gets compromised, watered down, weakened when everybody is a Christian and when everybody goes to chapel. Well, then what does it even mean to be a Christian? That's another discussion. The point for our purposes is just that in the 20th century, that separation between faith, religious life, the moral universe, and the rest of life gets increasingly separate. But it's not just a problem of secularism. I'm sure you've heard of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the German writer, theologian, who is known especially for his discussion of the concept that we refer to as cheap grace. He talked in the early years of the 20th century, talking especially about the German Lutheran Protestant context, about this development in the church of a concept of grace without discipleship, that we're saved by grace through faith. Nothing we can do makes any difference. We can't earn our favor with God. We're not going to earn our salvation. And although Luther would have never said it exactly like this, he came pretty close. So we shouldn't pay much attention to what we do. And what you end up with, Bonhoeffer said, is a theology of grace that doesn't demand anything. It's cheap grace. It's grace on clearance. It's like everybody can get grace easily, everywhere, always, because there's an oversupply, and whatever you need, it's always there available. So don't get preoccupied with like how you live. And Bonhoeffer looked around the German church of the first decades of the 20th century and he said, this is appalling. This is not authentic Christianity. And he wrote this little book called The Cost of Discipleship, where he's kind of reintroducing to the churches of his era the idea that we can't meaningfully talk about grace without also talking about discipleship. Of course, Mennonites in North America read Bonhoeffer and said, well, duh, like we've been talking about that for 500 years now, and they tried to kill us for saying it. it's nice that, you know, Lutherans have finally gotten on board or whatever. So we liked Bonhoeffer. But I don't know that what he was saying was irrelevant to Mennonite churches in North America either, because many of those same dynamics affected churches in our part of the world. What are the consequences of cheap grace? Well, you get churches where belief is pretty easy. You just say a sinner's prayer sometime, and then, you know, you join a mega church and show up once a week and have cool worship, and then everything's good. And I'm not saying that to disparage mega churches. We'll talk about church later. The real result of that sort of development, even in church, I think we could say, is that sin increasingly is seen as trivial. Like, we know it's there. We know that there's sin, but it's not a huge problem. And you certainly don't read about it in the press. Like, if you read about the folks whose behavior gets examined by American journalists, you can see the discussions about, like, whether they should have done that or not, or whether if they did that, that disqualifies them from public office. You can perhaps think of prominent examples of these discussions from the past few years. But what's never talked about in those, like, you'll never see the word sin in those discussions. You'll never see any of that framed as that was an offense against God or an offense against the moral order. Now, maybe someone would frame it as a transgression of commonly accepted kind of rules about the way people should behave, the things that are kind of allowed to do and the things that they aren't allowed to do. But in the public sphere, we don't even have categories for talking about that anymore. It's like behaviors that in the political sphere may derail somebody's career. In the celebrity world, in the Hollywood world, in the sports world, we celebrate and we write, you know, sort of breaking news stories that now this person's sleeping with this person. Hooray, isn't that exciting? So we celebrate, but then we critique. We try to critique, but we don't know how to critique because we've lost the categories. When sin becomes trivialized, the challenge even for the church is, How do we take sin seriously? This is an old problem, actually. And if we go back to the Middle Ages, it's interesting to see the way discussions of sin developed in the Roman Catholic tradition with writers like Thomas Aquinas, who gave a great deal of attention to sort of categories of sin and trying to create a kind of moral ledger in the medieval period. You've probably heard of venial sins and mortal sins. These were categories that the Catholic Church developed in the Middle Ages, and they actually still use to this day, that divide, like, serious sins from less serious sins. And here's the way the Catholic Catechism defines venial sins. One commits venial sin when, in a less serious matter, he does not observe the standard prescribed by the moral law, or when he disobeys the moral law in a grave matter, but without full knowledge or without complete consent. So I guess if you commit a sin, but you kind of tried not to, like, then that's a venial sin. But even for Catholics, it gets complicated to sort out the difference between venial sins, which aren't as serious, and mortal sins, which are. So here's some additional commentary to help you discern the difference. An act, when it is not ordered towards that which is good, is considered to be sinful, either venially or mortally. When such an act is venially sinful, it entails subject matter that is not considered to be grave. Such an action, even if it is committed with full knowledge and full consent, remains venial so long as the subject matter of the act is not serious. If the subject matter of a given act is grave, however, the commission of that act may be mortally sinful. Intentional ignorance and hardness of heart increase the voluntary nature of the sin. Thus, in discussing the distinction between venial and mortal sin in his Summa Theologica, St. Thomas Aquinas, the great theologian of the medieval period in the Catholic tradition, indicated that a venial sin differs from a mortal sin in the same way that something imperfect differs from something that is perfect. So if you commit venial sins, it adds to the penance that you need to do. And venial sins, it turns out, don't actually have to be confessed to be forgiven. Mortal sins do. Ideally, venial sins will be confessed, but it's kind of optional. If you don't confess venial sins before you die, they add to your suffering in purgatory after you die. And this is according to the Magisterium, the teaching office of the Catholic Church. Currently, venial sins usually remain venial no matter how many one commits. They cannot add up to collectively constitute a mortal sin. So I guess if you're a Roman Catholic, you can sin in minor ways, like over and over and over again, and they don't like accumulate, which sounds really cool to me. And their accumulation does not lead to mortal sin, but there are cases where repeat offenses may become a grave matter. For example, if you were to steal small amounts of property from a particular person, over time, you would have stolen enough that it would develop into a serious theft from that person. And that might actually add up over time to be a mortal sin. Now, in all of this, Catholic theologians are quick to point out, you ought not to take this to mean that venial sins can be committed lightly. No one without a special grace, for example, the Virgin Mary, can avoid even semi-deliberate venial sins entirely. This is according to the Council of Trent in the 1560s, right after the Reformation. But you need to try as much as possible to overcome venial sins, but you won't be able to. And then these questions about, well, was it deliberate, or was it semi-deliberate, or was it not deliberate? Like, oh, this, it's very complex, which I think you can see explains why Protestants have typically thought that this was a somewhat dangerous approach, that to try to carve up the world of sin into, well, yes, I did this, and it was kind of deliberate, kind of, except I didn't really want to do that, but I did anyway. So was it deliberate? Well, it was semi-deliberate. Was I ignorant? Well, I mean, I probably knew it wasn't a good idea, but I didn't realize it, like, I was going to get in that much trouble for it, or I didn't think I'd get caught, or I didn't think that that person would find out. I mean, you can see where this is just a minefield of trying to categorize sin. Protestants, I think, correctly, have, for the most part, rejected this categorization of sin as unhelpful, unbiblical, and not especially promising for the development of a life of discipleship. But then the question for us might be, so do we have, is there a kind of evangelical Christian counterpart to this? And if you think about your own church, if you think about your own life, if I think about my own life, let's just keep it with something that I actually know about. If I think about my own life, that tendency is very much there. The things that we might do that we say, well, yeah, I mean, technically that's probably not right, but it's not a big deal. I mean, isn't that exactly the same thing? And, you know, then it gets really complicated when you bring this into Christians' relationship with government and the state. You know, most of us would probably say, well, even if everybody cheats on their taxes, followers of Jesus, you know, probably shouldn't. Like, we ought to follow the law, because there seems to be clear instruction in Scripture to sort of honor the government, obey the government, respect the society we're in. So we might not do that, but when might we sort of bend law, ignore law, say, well, yeah, whatever. I mean, it's probably wrong, but we might have kind of a catalog of our own. The seriousness of trivializing sin, I think, we only need to look around the church to see some. We see the results. We see the studies that say, you know, divorce rates among evangelical born-again Christians are really shockingly high in comparison to the mainstream. The number of young adults at evangelical Christian colleges sleeping together seems to be distressingly high. And these are in communities where, you know, we're not Catholics. We're born again evangelical Christians, but sin, it's hard to keep a handle on. Very quickly, in Scripture, if we look at the words the Scripture uses in the Old Testament, the word, you can look up the Hebrew words if you care about Hebrew roots. We're not going to use them here. The word which has the idea of missing the mark, like you were aiming at a thing and you missed it, gets used more than 600 times. A word which doesn't mean so much missing the mark as crossing over. Like, here's the line, don't cross that line, but you cross the line. That's a commonly used word to refer to sin. There's also words that carry more the idea not of missing a goal or crossing over, but of revolt and rebellion. There's words used for sin that have to do with the idea of things being bent or twisted or perverted, like not what they were intended to be. If some of you have perhaps read C.S. Lewis's Space Trilogy, and you remember the sort of the representation of evil in the Space Trilogy is the bent one. The one that, like, it was made a certain way and then it got bent. It's misshapen. So that's an Old Testament category. In the New Testament, the word used most often is the counterpart to that Old Testament word, missing the mark. Like, I intended to do this and I missed it. And here the word that undergirds our translation as the word sin is hamartia. And I include that here simply because hamartia is the word which theologians borrow to give a fancy label to the division of systematic theology which studies sin. So the study of sin in Christian theology is called hamartiology. We don't use it so often. We talk about eschatology. We know that word. We talk about theology, doctrine of God. We talk about Christology, but we don't so often use hamartiology. But you might run into it somewhere. The idea of trespass. Forgive us our trespasses. Here the idea is crossing over. Don't go there. That's a line. Don't cross that line. Cross that line, you've trespassed. It's a word which we use in English in a variety of ways. No trespassing. Like, don't come across our property line. Unrighteousness is a word the New Testament uses. Ungodliness or impiety. So there's all these different words that are used to try to capture what sin is, if we kind of reduce it to its essence. What is the essence of sin? And people have proposed different things. The sort of the fundamental thing in human sinfulness is pride. So that's a common one. You know, the Lucifer's original sin, we think, might have been pride, like wanting to be like God. So that's a possibility. But we can also talk about sin as being a fundamental stance of rebellion. Like, don't tell me what to do. I know God said that, but... So there's that. I had an instructor once who said he thinks maybe the best definition that he's been able to come up with is sin as a denial of reality. And maybe that captures all of these other things. When you're proud, you're denying reality. You're trying to be something that, in fact, you're not. When you rebel against the God who made you, you're denying reality. You're not going to win this one. Like, God made you. He made you with intention, with purpose, with a plan that he knows is for your good, that's going to work. And you don't have to follow that. You can try to do something else, but you're denying the reality of who you are and who you were made to be and what you were created to do. So maybe that's another helpful one. Original sin is a category we need to discuss a little bit, and that you can study a lot more if you're interested. What is original sin? Well, a couple of things that it's not. It's not the sinfulness that was part of our original constitution. God didn't make us as sinful creatures. It's also not the sin of Adam and Eve in the garden. It's not original. And when we talk about original sin, we don't mean Adam and Eve's sin. What do we mean? What we mean when we talk about original sin is the sin which derives somehow from the origin of the human race, all the way beginning back in the first thing that we know about human history. And it's been with us ever since. So we use original in that sense. We also mean original sin is that thing which explains our sinful condition. It's the origin, in a sense, of all actual sins. Where does sin come from? Well, it's related to original sin. But it turns out this concept is problematic. So I'm going to introduce the problem, and then perhaps after lunch, before we launch into salvation, we'll come back and say a little bit more about this problem. Why is original sin a problem? Well, it's a problem on the one hand because it seems difficult to explain how people like Adam and Eve, if they were originally created righteous, like, how could they fall? Like, how does the impulse to sin, like, where does it even come from in a perfect world? And that's not an easy thing to explain. It's also problematic because to the extent that original sin explains our sinful condition, then it also seems to imply that we have responsibility somehow for things that we did not choose. Like, did you choose to be born with a sin nature? I don't think so. I mean, I didn't, that I can recall. And yet, we also say that we're responsible before God for our sin. But we didn't choose it, did we? Well, we didn't choose original sin. We, in fact, did choose our actual sins. Or if we want to borrow medieval Catholic terminology, we could say that our sins were at least semi-deliberate. We kind of wanted to sin, but maybe not completely. I don't know. Are we guilty for Adam and Eve's sin? That's a big discussion in Christian theology. Are we guilty for someone else's wrong? And if we are, what about human freedom? Like, aren't we people of choice? Aren't we people that get to make real, meaningful decisions? And yet the doctrine of original sin seems to tell us that, well, maybe not completely. Like, actually, maybe you don't. Maybe you don't have complete freedom. Well, how do you make sense of that? And then there's questions about children. Jesus says, don't forbid the children, let them come. The kingdom of heaven belongs to ones like this. Well, don't they have original sin stamped all over them? I flew yesterday from San Jose, Costa Rica to Atlanta, Georgia, one row behind a two-year-old girl that I am confident did have original sin stamped all over her. So there's no doubt in my mind that she at least was born with original sin. And we need to leave it right there. We'll come back to this after lunch. Thanks.